Okay, let's turn the clock back over 50 years ago. Wow, it's such a long time, and yet when I begin recalling where I was and what I did and what I experienced during the Six-Day War, and I feel like it was yesterday, even though it was all those years ago. So I was a young girl in 1966, and I had decided to spend a year in Israel studying in Machon Gold. I was very much involved in Bnei Akiva, the Bnei Akiva movement, and I remember in those days there was a very big discussion: when you come to Israel, should you go to a kibbutz? Should you go to an Eir Pituach, developmental town? But definitely not to go and live in town. You have to do something really idealistic. Well, anyway, I chose not to go to the kibbutz for the year, but to come to Israel. Now, it was the first time that I'd taken a plane. It was the first time I'd left England. And I just remember my mother saying to me, who also had never left England, "Listen, you can't take a heavy suitcase with you." In those days, it was like whatever plane you traveled on, it was like going EasyJet. "You can't take a heavy suitcase with you. So just wear 4 layers or 5 layers of clothes, and that way you'll be fine." But she didn't realize that by the time I had arrived in Israel from England, it was 35 degrees in Tel Aviv, and I was ready to faint. So the first thing I did when I landed was to walk into the men's bathroom to take off my clothes. And only when I had walked into the bathroom did I realize that it was the men's bathroom, because I didn't see the sign in Hebrew. Anyway, it was quite a rough trip, actually, and in fact, it was so rough that the plane left England for Switzerland, and then we were in Switzerland for about an hour, and then we took off from Switzerland, but there was a storm, and so we had to come back to Switzerland. And by the time I got to Israel, I wrote my mother a letter, and I said, "You know what? I feel like Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't enter the land; he was just had a sniff of the land. I felt when I was on that plane that I was going to get a sniff of the land." Well, Baruch Hashem, that didn't happen. Didn't happen, and I'm here. Anyway, so I arrive in Israel, and I imagine that everybody would be running around here with a Kovat Embel. Do you remember the Kovat Embel that everybody used to wear? I thought that everybody would be running around with a Kovat Embel, and by the time I would get to Yerushalayim, all the people in the street would be singing, "Heyveinu Shalom Aleichem." And it wasn't like that either, but I wasn't warned that if I take a box of Cadbury's chocolate to Israel, by the time I get to Yerushalayim, will have melted. But that also didn't happen, because I put the box of chocolates next to the taxi driver, and by the time we reached the entrance to Yerushalayim, the box had already been totally consumed by him. So that was okay. So I was in Israel, I was in Yerushalayim, and it was like love at first sight, and I just could not believe that I was here, and I was so excited, and I was on such a high, and I said, I know that I've come home." And I felt it so strongly and with such a passion, and I don't even know how to explain it in words. Now, Israel in 1966 looked very, very different than it looks like today. And I'm really now focusing on Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, the borders around Yerushalayim was a divided city. And it was divided in such a way that it looked like somebody had taken, one of my students said this to me yesterday when I was speaking to her about this on Shabbat. She said, and I was trying to explain to her, and she said, "You know what? What you're referring to is it looked like someone took a big bite out of it." So I said, "Yeah, more or less, right? The borders were not, it wasn't like a circle, it wasn't a square, but the borders were inconsistent, they were rugged borders." And I studied at Machon Gold. By the way, can you just imagine what that was for a young girl to be dealing with a name like Golda Goldfield from Machon Gold? Can you just imagine that? That was a tough one. Golda Goldfield from Machon Gold. You know, when I got to the Michlala, every time Rav Kupperman used to see me, he used to say to me, "Hi, Golda Goldfield from Machon Gold, you know, give me a break." Anyway, Baruch Hashem, though, I didn't marry someone by the name of Goldberg, otherwise I really would have been in trouble. Anyway, so Yerushalayim was a divided city, and that meant that there were no planes that flew over. That was in agreement after the war in 1948, that no planes would fly over Yerushalayim. But everywhere you went, you were on the border. I was on Rehov HaTurim, which is right close to Malchey Yisrael, and it was right opposite the Jordan. The Jordan, it was in the hands of the Jordanians. The East Jerusalem, as you know, was in the hands of the Jordanians. If you went to Meir Shearim and you walked all the way down Meir Shearim, you got to the Mandelbaum Gate. There again, there was a border. If you made a right turn towards Shaar Yafo and you passed, you got to Shaar Yafo, there was a huge, huge iron metal wall and with a big notice stuck in front of it saying, Atzor ha'gvul lefanecha, stop, the border is in front of you. And I recall on Tisha B'Av, and I think to myself today, I don't know how I did it, but we were young and we were full of mischief and fun. So it was Tisha B'Av, and I remember that we were fasting and we were in Machon Gordon, and we decided to go all the way around the borders of Jerusalem in the middle of the heat. I mean, it was crazy. But if you walk down Shivtei Yisrael, there's a most magnificent building that belongs to the Ministry of Education. So we climbed up to the top of the building and we tried to see into old Jerusalem to try and get a peek, get a glance of the Kotel. But of course, there was no way that you could see. And then we took a bus and we traveled all the way to Ramat Rachel, which is a kibbutz south of Jerusalem. And there's like a huge tall tower, and we climbed up to the top of the tower to try and see Kever Rachel, but of course we could not see Kever Rachel either. And then we also climbed up to Hatzion. Hatzion was then in our hands, but we climbed up to Hatzion. It was all on Tisha B'Av. We were all fasting, the group of youngsters, and we tried to see over, and we couldn't see anything. We could just like imagine what the Kotel looked like, what it meant to have Har HaBayit in our hands, but it was very, very far from a reality. Very far from reality. Now, Jerusalem in those days, first of all, like getting on the buses there, we got on a bus just today also. I mean, it can be very, very crowded, but there was no air conditioning, and people would get on buses in Machane Yehuda with their chickens and with their garinim, and they'd be spitting their garinim in all directions, you know. So at least people didn't have cell phones then, so at least people smiled at each other and spoke to each other, and by the time you got to the end of your journey, you already know the person that was sitting next to you, you knew their whole life story. So it was very, very different living in Jerusalem then than it is today. So I also recall that year, I'm moving now forward, that of course there were no cell phones and there was no email, and I didn't speak to my parents from July 66 to the beginning of June 67. We corresponded, we had emails, you're right, you wrote them every week. I wrote them a letter, and my mom would answer the letters. And I just remember her saying, writing a letter, she had never left England, but their plans, nothing to do with the Six-Day War, we hadn't gotten there yet. Her plans were to come to Israel in the summer 67, together with my father, and she said she was gonna daven at Kever Rachel. So I wrote back to her and I said, well, today in Hebrew we say chaya b'seret, which means you live in a movie, you know. So I didn't use those words to my mother then, but you know, like I wrote to her and I said, you know, you can't get to Kever Rachel, you can't daven at Kever Rachel. Kever Rachel is not in our hands, it's in the hands of the Jordanians. So she wrote back and she said, no, I have to get there because I promised my mom that I would daven at Kever Rachel. Okay, you know, you should be gezun. But I mean, it was far from a reality. So this is the way that we corresponded throughout the year. Now, I had also decided that I really wanted to stay in Israel, and I was determined. I didn't speak Hebrew yet, but I decided that I would speak only in Hebrew, so I tried that year, and there were a lot of American girls studying with me, to try and speak only Hebrew so that I'd be able to feel that I'm really part of Eretz Israel. Now, when the 3 weeks before the a war broke out. First of all, two events that I'd like to mention. One event is that there was a song festival in Binyanei HaUma, and Nomi Sheva was asked by Teddy Kollek to write a song about Yerushalayim, so that somebody would sing it in between the first part of the song festival and the second song part of the song festival. So she wrote this song, which of course today is almost like the anthem of Am Yisrael, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, and she asked she asked Shuni Natan to sing this song. Now, I recall, even though I wasn't in Binyanei HaUmah, we heard it on the radio, right? Then, of course, everybody was crowding around this old radio. So we heard it on the radio. And what happened there was she got such an applause for that song. It wasn't even to take place. It wasn't even part of the songs that were sung formally. And she was applauded. People got stood up, and they were so excited about this song. And of course, you know, the last paragraph of that song was, the old city is empty, and that we can't go down to Yam HaMelech Derech Yericho, and there's no voices heard there. And it was like, it's very sad. And then again, Yerushalayim shel zahav, v'shel nechoshet v'shel or, halo l'kol shirayich ani kinor. So I remember that song. It suddenly became part of our consciousness. The second short anecdote that I want to tell you, it's not really an anecdote, but it's a very short little story. Every year in Yeshivat Merkaz Harav, they celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut, Erev Yom HaAtzmaut, there's davening, and then Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, he speaks. So apparently, and this was also something that we heard very quickly, he stood up and he went and Toch Kadei, while he was speaking, he was very passionate, and he said, Where is Kever Rachel? Where is Kever Yosef? Where is Hebron? Where is Maragat HaMachpelah? In other words, why are these places not in our hands? It's almost like Niba Velo Yada Maniba. He prophesied, but he didn't know what he was prophesying. But we heard about that. We had connections. We knew people that were studying there. We heard this. Now, very shortly after Yom HaAtzmaut, Natsa, who was the president of Egypt, began his warlike action. But it wasn't something totally new, because from 1948 until 1967, the Israelis that were living around the Kinneret constantly suffered from bombing from Syria, from Ramat HaGolan. Ramat HaGolan was in the hands of the Syrians, and they were constantly bombing us. And they, were, of course, were supported by the Russians. Okay, and Natsar, who was beaten, who was defeated in 1956, right, in the Sinai campaign, he made an oath. I'm going to quote him now. He made an oath that he was going to overcome Israel, and that he would he would take over the country, and that he would throw all of us into the sea. Let me just quote something here. In 1965, Natsar said, "We shall not enter Palestine with its soil covered in sand, we shall enter it with its soil saturated in blood." So this is what he said in 1965, and that was his intention. He was building up his army, and now I'm not going according to the dates here, because I'm presenting this in, you know, from my perspective, and therefore, if I'm not being exact with the dates, it could be May the 18th, it could be May the 16th, but in the month of May. So his first warlike act was that he closed the Straits of Tiran, okay, and after that, he told the United Nations troops that were placed in Sinai between our troops and the Egyptian troops to leave. In other words, here we are now opposite the Egyptians. And he's constantly talking about that he's going to wage war against us. And in fact, I even saw a stamp that he had put out with a picture of the map of Israel. And across the map, was his hand, like as if to say he is in charge, he is now ruling over Eretz Israel, and he's going to throw us, right, and it was the sea, he was going to be throwing us into the sea. Now, we had one radio for, I don't know how many girls we were, maybe we were 30 girls there, 40 girls there, one radio. So how much really did we know? We knew enough to know that the Israeli the Israelis, the men above the age of 18, those that were not in the army, but those that were, those that were in the army were in the army, but those that were not in the army were being called up to Miluim. And how were they being called up to Miluim? They had like code names. So we'd hear all of a sudden, while we were listening to the radio, you'd suddenly hear, afternoon tea, afternoon tea. And those people that knew that that was their code name, they would go. Or chocolate surprise, or check brown trousers. Each unit had a call-up code, and they knew that when they heard that, they heard themselves, then their code, that they had to present themselves at a certain place. And among those people was Amadrich, Dubi Goldflam, who was a parachutist, and he was wounded in the Old City, but he was also, so he was called up. Now, our families in America and England, and I'm saying in England because I was the only one from England in Machon Gold, but from America, France, South America, we began getting letters to come home immediately, because the situation is deteriorating. And if, God forbid, war breaks out, my mother, I'm going to read you some of her letters in one moment, and if, God forbid, war breaks out, my daughter is not going to be under fire. I have to add that I didn't realize then, being a young girl, how scary that must have been for her. I'm going to share with you something now in parentheses, and that is that I have two daughters in Sderot. And I have another daughter who is close by there as well. And they're trying to get out of there now to come to my home. And what they're going through now, well, I don't have to tell you because you all have, you know the news, okay? But what I was feeling like before I left the house, I said to myself, look, I'm speaking about how special it was to be in Yerushalayim during the Six-Day War. And I felt myself trembling, and then immediately I became much more aware of what my parents must have been going through. And my father, Zichroni Vracha, who had escaped the Holocaust before the Second World War, but had lost almost his entire family, he was absolutely going out of his mind. And I have telegrams, you know, telegram is every word, you pay for every word. Come home immediately. I have the telegram here, but it's falling apart already. Come home immediately. Your father's ill already. And so what, you know, what was I going to do? And they could see on the screen, on the television, that there were masses and masses of Arabs, and they were in Cairo. They were screaming, you know, holy war, holy war. And their daughter is in Yerushalayim, and she, God forbid, she may be under fire. Yes, we were under bombing. We were in Yerushalayim, we were under bombing. So I was in a predicament. Well, yes and no. I was in a predicament because I had to figure out how I was going to call my parents. But there was no way that I would leave Eretz Yisrael. No way. I was 100% sure that I would never, ever leave Israel during a time of danger. And I wrote to my mother, I have the letters here as well, we'll see with time if we get to some of these letters. I wrote to her, I said, would a mother leave her sick child? Would she desert her sick child? So how can I leave Eretz Yisrael? But that was only later, because I wanted to like play a game with her. I said, don't worry, everything's okay, I'm taking care. So and then she said, contact the British consul, you must come back. So I reckon if I contact the British consul, I won't be lying to her. I'll be able to say to her, I contacted the British consul, but I didn't intend listening to them. Now I have to read you the letter that I got from the British consul, because every time I read it, as the English say, it really tickles me. I mean, it's really funny. Okay, so. Sir, Madam, in view of the present situation, I would suggest you should urgently consider the desirability of leaving Jerusalem without delay. This may only be possible while public transport services exist. And I must make it clear that Her Majesty's representatives have no special means for providing transport for you and your family should you fail to act upon this warning and public services cease to operate. Whatever action you may decide upon as the result of this warning must be taken on your own responsibility. But in reaching a decision, you should remember that the longer you delay, the more difficult your subsequent departure may become. I should be grateful if you would inform me of your decision at the earliest possible moment. She's still waiting. I am, sir, madam, your obedient servant, Her Majesty's Consul General. So I received the letter, and of course I told my parents everything is fine, but then there was an article in the Jewish Chronicle, and they saw this, and then they really were livid. I'm reading part of it. Scores of young British Jews studying here or simply visiting the country are ignoring advice to return home. Another student who is disobeying parental orders is Golda Goldfield of Hendon, who is nearing the end of a year's Jewish Agency teacher's training course. She is doing first aid and working in a hospital. Okay. So once they saw that, they knew that, how do we say, the party's over. Right. Anyway, so before I, again, read some more parts of letters that my mother wrote to me, I said to myself, well, if I have decided to stay here, I have to be useful. I'm not going to just sit around with my arms folded, you know, I have to help. So I went to where Terem is today, and I took a first aid course with a few other girls. We took this first aid course. But it was kind of detached from it, like, this isn't going to be real, this isn't for real, I'm not going to be using it. You know, I mean, I faint at the sight of blood, so be loud. Anyway, so I took the first aid course, and then we went to the Shaari Tzedek Hospital, and we sat in the air raid shelter there, and we prepared all the equipment, and we also filled up sandbags to fill up the windows with sandbags. So there was a lot of preparation before the war broke out. Now, we were from Chutz La'aretz, so we were quite innocent, but Israelis were preparing for a mass disaster. Thousands of graves were dug in Tel Aviv. They thought that this was going to be, the whole country was going to be, would be destroyed. Now, I'm going to just, again, so these were the two, I was in Shaari Tzedek, and then later on when the war broke out, I went to the departments there, and we took care of the wounded, and we helped the nurses. So, that was the first, that was with the volunteering. I did another piece of volunteering, which I'll share with you shortly. But I just want to just read some of the, quote some of the letters that crossed between my mother and myself. The letters. Right, 50 years old they are, okay, you know. Okay, so, okay. This is one of the, contact British consulate, you're coming home immediately, mother. Okay, and then I answer her, registered at consulate, taking all precautions, no danger, almighty with us, no need to return. Oh, that was the answer. Okay. I'm right, this is the 24th of May. Everyone is really calm, I'm not at all worried about the position I have in Munayin Hashem, I think it will pass over. And if Chas v'Chalila it doesn't, it'll turn out Bezrat Hashem for the good. However, there is a natural feeling of tension and excitement inside me, which is, again, natural since we keep hearing the news. And also because Machon Gaur is right opposite an army camp, so we keep seeing trucks, jeeps, and buses running in and out all through the night. So that was part of one postcard. And this is from Kaf Hei Iyar already. That's already after the war finished. Words are insufficient to tell you how I feel at the moment. I only wrote to you this morning. So much has happened since then that I hardly know where to begin. Yerushalayim is going mad. People are dancing and singing in the streets, and together with the soldiers, and they keep going past with jeeps, and they're waving, and they throw souvenirs that they found from the Jordanians. We saw many cars. I see Jordanian cars. I heard on the radio that all the soldiers at the Kotel, from all the soldiers when they were at the Kotel Maravi, one of them spoke, and he said, "I cried and I said, I wasn't dati, but now I've just witnessed such a miracle, and therefore I'm now going to be I'm going to become dati." We had all the soldiers saying Shechianu. And then I write of the different souvenirs that I received. This is a letter from my mother beforehand, and sorry it's not in order. We are all, every Jew, concerned with the situation. Wherever you go, everyone is very upset, but everybody's solidly behind Israel. I attended a rally at Hyde Park yesterday, and there were over 5,000 people there. But this doesn't help us. We are worried about you, and you know your dad and what he is. All this makes him so ill, so you will be prudent. Oh, that's a good word. And return home. And if, God forbid, and I can't begin to think of it, such a thing, anything should happen, you have to bring, I had an uncle who was living here, you have to bring him, like as if I was able to bring my uncle. You have to bring your my uncle and the children with. We don't care about your finals compared to your safety. I had finals from Machon Gaur. So that was one letter. And then another one. And then this was immediately afterwards. Okay, my darling Gold, I do hope you are well and safe. And what can I say? I'm sorry I sent the telegrams, but the first day there was panic here, as you can imagine. We have just heard on the radio that the old city of Jerusalem is now, Baruch Hashem, a million times in our hands. How wonderful. But what a terrible pity there was so much bloodshed. May God go with our wonderful army right through to victory. Where were you when all this was going on? I hope you were evacuated out of the city. I'm waiting for a letter from you or some word. Please take precautions. Okay. Right. So this is from Mandy. This was the day that the war broke out. And a week afterwards. It's just a week since war was declared. It is impossible to describe our feelings. And now the wonderful delight and wonder. And then she writes, when your dad came home, he wouldn't eat anything on that day. So he was looking for company, and we sat with company. And Levi Eshkol had said that the Egyptian Air Force is finished. We hurried home, and we turned on the radio and the television, and it was full of news. Now, the morning that the war broke out, we had to surprise them, right? We had to surprise them. We were planning this for 3 weeks beforehand. So there had to be the element of surprise. So on Monday morning, when we heard the sirens, everybody ran down the steps and went into the air raid shelter. I was in my room, I was studying for exams. And I wasn't sure whether the siren was for real or not. I thought maybe this was they were just practicing a drill, you know? So I didn't go straight away, but then I looked out of the window and I saw everybody dashing into air raid, into different houses, looking for air raid shelters. So I said, I'd better go downstairs. So I went downstairs, we went downstairs, and everybody was saying Tehillim. And then they turned on the radio. But you have to understand the situation then was so different to today, than today, because today, if a soldier wants, to, and this I'm telling you from my, again, personal experience, I have sons in the army, sons-in-law who are in the army, grandsons, I have two grandsons in the army right now. So I'm telling you that today, if a soldier wants to use his rifle, if he sees somebody suspicious, he's going to have to ask his officer. And then his officer is going to have to ask the higher officer. And then the higher officer is going to ask someone else. And by the time he gets a word, already the Arab is nowhere to be seen. Or maybe he'll be able to shoot at his shoelace. Okay, that's today. It sounds funny, but it really is very, it's very, very serious. I'm quoting now one of my grandsons who is serving now in Judah and Samaria. And he said, the Arabs throw stones at us, and I can't shoot even at their, I can't even shoot in the air. And I said to him, how do you feel? And he said, I feel humiliated. Like, anyway. So then it was very different. The situation was just very, very different. And another thing is that nothing came to the news. You understand what I'm saying? We didn't hear anything on the radio. No one let on to what was going on. All you could hear on the radio was march music. March music all the time. Any of my parents knew already that the Egyptian Air Force was finished far before we knew. So at some point during the day, again, we're all in the air raid shelter, we're saying Tehillim, and we're trying to study for exams, and we can hear this music in the background, but all of a sudden we hear that the Egyptian army has been totally destroyed. Now, every time I say this sentence, the Egyptian army, the Air Force, has been totally wiped out, I go, this is like, it's really unreal, unbelievable, because if a country don't have an Air Force, then that's it. That's it. So they're really out of it. And how did that happen? It happened, obviously, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted it to happen, Yad Hashem, okay? That's on the Mishor HaRuchani, on the spiritual level. But on the Mishor HaEnushi, on the human level, on the practical, on the security level, airplanes flew low over the Mediterranean. And they bombed the airport, and the pilots there, they were having breakfast. They hadn't even gone into their plane. So they caught them offhand. So they didn't even manage to get, maybe some of them did, but they didn't last very long in their planes. And then they came back, the airplanes came back over Israel. They went over to Egypt. They went over the sea, the Mediterranean, but they came back over Israel. Now, Nasser had made a pact with Syria, and he made a pact with Jordan. And the biggest mistake that Hussein Melech, the king of Jordan, did, of course, that was good for us, was that he made a pact with Nasser, and he gave Nasser permission to be in charge of the Jordanian army, which is, if you think about it, it's meshugah, it's crazy, because, I mean, you know, like, how would the Israelis say, ma kesher, right? What's the connection? It's not Egypt's Egypt, and Jordan's Jordan. Okay, secondly, the Jordanian army was far superior, because they were trained by the British, so they were far superior. That there was a known fact that they were far superior to the Egyptian army. So why do they need to have an Eitzah? Why do they need to have advice from the Egyptians? Now, Nasser, realizing that there's no more air force, he can't suddenly come out with a statement that he's not waging war anymore against us. So he tells King Hussein that the Egyptian air force is bombing Tel Aviv. And King Hussein believes this. Why? Because they picked up on the planes coming back, but it didn't dawn on him that they were our planes, that they were Israeli planes. He thought that what Natsar said was the truth. Since when do Arabs tell the truth, right? So, but okay, he believed him. Okay. Now, Levi Eshkol, who was then the prime minister, through the representative of the United Nations, warned King Hussein not to enter war. Why didn't he want to enter? Why didn't he want to enter war? Because he said, we have Tsaras, we have war with the Egyptians. The Syrians are going to enter war. So we don't need another front. But since King Hussein was absolutely sure that the Egyptians were winning this war, okay, so he entered the war. So again, when we heard the sirens going, the sirens, we didn't realize that Jerusalem already was being bombed. It was already being bombed. It was being bombed on the south, in the south of Jerusalem. It was being bombed towards the area of Ramallah, which is also pretty close. And so therefore, there was no choice but to enter the war with the Jordanians. So I'd like to read you, I have some very short sections from Time magazine that describe this this amazing feat, okay? Just one more point before I read some quotes from Time magazine. I recall hearing Rav Goren, who was the army chaplain during the Six-Day War, speaking to the soldiers and encouraging them before they went out to war. And it was the most moving, amazing, inspiring words. He was quoting from the Book of Devarim, and it says in the Book of Devarim, I'm not quoting exactly, but more or less, Atem Shema Yisrael. He turns towards all the soldiers, and he says, Shema Yisrael, Atem Yotzim LaMilchama. Oh, Shema Yisrael, you are going out to war, and there are people that they have plans to destroy us and to finish us up. The different words describe the destruction. And then he said, again, quoting from Sefer Devarim, don't fear them, don't be scared of them, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be your Moshiach. He will save you from this. And then he turned around and he said to them, Atem chayelei tzva hagana Yisrael, ha-makabim bedoreinu, the Maccabim of our time, Hashem Imachem, and save Am Yisrael from the hands of the enemy. And even now, when I'm recording this, I'm hearing his voice echoing in my ears. He wasn't just encouraging the soldiers, but he was encouraging all of Am Yisrael. So now I'm going to quote some quotes from the Time magazine. Very pro-Israel then. No amount of warning, however shrill, ever quite prepares a people for the air raid siren scream. The first wail is always difficult to believe. In Tel Aviv, Israel's largest city, the reaction was much the same, and with better reason. Only days before, new Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, the dashing one-eyed hero of Sinai, had said the time was not ripe to strike at the Arab forces gathering around the Jewish homeland. It is either too early or too late, he said. Either we should have reacted right away, or we should wait and see what are the results of diplomacy. This was no drill. In stunning pre-dawn airstrikes across the face of the Arab world, Israeli jets all but eliminated Arab air power, and with it any chance of Arab victory. Without air cover, tanks and infantry under the clear skies of the desert offered little more than target practice. By Monday night, the end of the first day's fighting, some 400 warplanes of five Arab nations had been obliterated. Hodu l'Hashem ki tov, ki li olam chesto. And another short quote. Then there was Jerusalem. For reasons deeper than strategy or security, Jerusalem is the one Israeli prize that is not negotiable. Any government that returned old Jerusalem to Jordan would surely collapse. Already the Israelis have raised the bunkers and blockhouses, dividing the city's two sectors, and bulldozers have leveled Arab huts to open a broad square before the waning wall. In the last week for the festival of Shavuot, which commemorates the handing down of the law to Moses, the old city was opened for the first time in 19 years to ordinary Israelis. And then, again, Time magazine. Almost every text and ritual of the Jewish faith recalls the land that the biblical Israelites seized from the Canaanites, and to which, according to Genesis, Abraham received the title deed from God. This religious tradition has maintained a sense of community among Jews scattered over the world. If I forget you, O Israel, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its cunning. I'm short for time. I'm going to miss out some points, and I'm going to... I just remember sitting on that Wednesday morning, we all sat in the air raid shelter, and all of a sudden, one of our teachers, whose name was Yehuda Kiel, great Talmid Chacham, he brought out Dat Mikra, if you're familiar with it, the commentary of Dat Mikra. So Yehuda Kiel somehow gets to the Machon Gold on Wednesday morning, and when we're all like huddling around this radio, and we hear "Ha habayit biyadenu, ha habayit biyadenu." He said the news brought the caster. He said, "I'm not a religious man, but I can see now that everybody, the soldiers are rushing to the Kotel." And then we hear "Shechianu v'kimanu v'giyanu lazman hazeh," and there we were in this tiny little room, and there was a bottle of wine, and we all drank the chayim, and then we rushed outside, and then we see soldiers coming back from the front, and everybody was dancing and singing. It was literally crazy. And then we went back in and we went down into the air raid shelter, and he opened up this huge map and he said, "Now I have to test you now on the geography." So we said, like, "What?" You know, he said, "Well, where's the border of?" And then we're talking, you know, and the building is still shaking. "Where's the border? That's a good question. Where's the border? I don't know. I don't think you know either." So he laughed. He pulled down the map of Israel. He scrolled it up. And that was the end of it. We did not take that test. I mean, there was no way. Anyway, so then on that Wednesday afternoon, I did something very irresponsible. I thought that they'd stopped shooting. And I said, "I have to go and see how my aunt and uncle are. And they live in Hada'am. I have to go visit them." So I left without telling anybody. I left Machon Gold. I ran all the way down Malchei Yisrael. I made a right turn. I ran all the way to Rehov Yafo. And I'm all running, and then I don't see, there's no one in the streets. So, well, I don't know why there's no one in the street, maybe, anyway. So then I continued running, and then I get to the Bet Knesset, well, there was no Bet Knesset Agadol then, there was the Hechal Shlomo, and which is right opposite the old city, and all of a sudden I can hear shooting, there was still shooting going on, I'm talking about Wednesday afternoon. So what did I do? I saw movies about when people run away from shooting, they zigzag. So I zigzagged all the way down Rehov Karen Ayasod, I zigzagged, and then I made a right turn into Rehov Hada'am, and there were a bunch of soldiers for the United Nations that had been taken from a hotel in the old city and put there, and they said to me, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm going to visit my auntie." So anyway, so I went to visit my auntie. I went inside. She fainted when she saw me coming quickly, you know. And I held in my hand something from a Jordanian, whatever, one of these, you know, things that Jordanian from Jordan. But I had, she said, take it away. Anyway, so I sat with my aunt and uncle, and then we spoke. And then in the evening I came back, and of course everyone, anyway. So that was, and then of course, Shavuot, Chag HaShavuot. So we pussy spent the whole night learning. And at 4:30 in the morning, one of our teachers, his name was Rav Eliezer Eliner. He was a very, very tall guy, had very, very long fingers. I just recall that. And I remember when he taught us, when he used to teach us, and he'd take us to different places, and he would say, "That is where Yehoshua said," and then he would quote, or this is where this particular shofet, this is where this happened. And this is how we learnt this is how we learned Nach when we were in Machangold. You live, Eretz Yisrael, you live Nach. It's not like something far away, something technical. So this Eliezer Eli there, he stands in front of all of them. He says to us, we are now going now to Daven for the first time at the Kotel HaMaravi. And this is a place that we have been davening since 1948, but for thousands of years, this really truly has not really been in our hands. Now it truly is truly in our hands. So we went outside and we danced all the way down to Geula and all the way up King George to where the old railway station is, and then we went around Hatzion where the buses come back, and there were the police had put up like gates so that people wouldn't be pushing and it wouldn't be too crowded, and on the sides of the road that we travel on today as well around Hatzion, we see all these shlatim, all these posts saying Atzor ha'gvul lefanecha, stop, the border is before you, but they were thrust to the side, and of course everybody was cheering, and everybody was, truly, when we arrived at the Kotel, I really thought, twice in my life I felt that. One time, that was then, I felt when I got to the Kotel that in any minute, the Bet HaMikdash would come right down, the heavens would open up, the Bet HaMikdash would come down, and it would be, and Kippat HaZahav there, the golden mosque there, would be swallowed up under the ground, and the Bet HaMikdash would take its place, and we would go right from there. We would go to the Bet HaMikdash, because Har HaBayit B'Yadeinu is Har HaBayit B'Yadeinu. Har HaBayit, the Kotel is an outer wall, but the aspiration is to reach Har HaBayit. How much time do I have? Get me. Oh God. Oh, I see. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Okay. Okay. So, I say that. And another thing that just quickly, another. So after the war, I also volunteered because they wanted to reopen the university up on Harat Safim. So I volunteered to dig up all the grass and the whatever had grown overgrown over the amphitheater there up on Harat Safim. We were like a bunch of students. We spent 2 days cleaning up the amphitheater there so that they could reopen it. But then they said that it was only for VIPs. You're doing the dirty work, but it's only for VIPs. And I said, that's what they think. So on the day that it opened up, and I didn't have an invitation, but I got somebody to give me a lift. I hitchhiked to Harat Safim, and I kind of mingled together with the crowds, and I was present at the reopening of the university at Harat Sofim. And by the way, I have a daughter called Sophia, who was the first baby girl to be born in Harat Sofim when the hospital reopened in 1977. So this is only part of it. It's only the icing above it. And Baruch Hashem, in less than a year, I had to go back to England for one reason or another. And then I made plans to make Aliyah, and I left England on Yud Ba'av, on the 10th of Av. It was a fast day. I had to ask a Shelat Rav if I could leave for Israel on Yud Ba'av. And this is what he said, and with this I'm finishing. I asked Rabbi Geles, Zecher Yitzadik Livracha, and he said, the spy spoke negatively about Eretz Israel, and that was on Tisha Ba'av. Rashi says there, Vayivku balayla ahu, and they cried on that night. Rashi says, you cried, it was a bechi lachinam. It was a bechi for no reason. I'll give you something to cry about. And then he said to me, you're going back to Eretz Israel on the Yud Ba'av is a tikkun for chet hamaraglim. Tzodah.